Okay, so hope you had a good Easter weekend. Nice to be back. So let's start recapping what we did last time so that we remember the notation and the objects. And then today we will start looking at gravity finally. So we started from a Lagrangian. So this is the recap of covariant phase space method. So we start from a Lagrangian density, which is a top form on spacetime and a function, so a zero form on field space. We take its field variation and we split the resulting field space one form into a source form, which is the Euler-Lagrange equation of motion, and an exact spacetime exact term, which gives us the covariant symplectic potential. Covariant symplectic potential. And I call this a current because it's a top minus one form, exactly like its variation, field variation, omega, which is now a two form on field space. And so we have noticed that, the first theorem we had proved is that on shell, this omega is conserved, and therefore, when we integrate it on any Cauchy surface, this gives us a good. Is implied that the space of on shell fields, together with omega integrated on a Cauchy surface, is pretty much. A description of phase space. Sorry. Yes.
I have a question about the convention that we're using. By more in bottle, we mean like off shell, right?
On shell.
On top, it would be on shell.
I know the bar underline is just to say that they are forms, that they are not integrated. I use bold in the notes, but I cannot do bold on the blackboard, so I underline when it's differential forms on M. Just to remember that is not an integrated. Then we said, okay, what happens if we add symmetries? So what is a symmetry? Is a Lagrangian symmetry. Well, we need two things. We need an action on our space of fields. So this is our row, which takes a Lie algebra and maps it onto vector fields on F, which are infinitesimal transformations of the fields. And we require that they behave as they should, so the Lie algebra is actually reflected in the algebra of the transformations on field space. Then what we want to ask is that our Lagrangian is invariant under the symmetry, and we don't have to require that this is zero. It's enough to require that this is a total divergence, so an exact term. Then, Noether first theorem told us that if we combine, we can build a current out of theta and this r. Minus r. So this is the Noether current. And Noether first theorem told us that this current is conserved on shell. We actually also wrote what the formula on the right-hand side is. It's proportional to the equations of motion, and now I think if I remember correctly, it should be something like that. But the important thing is that it vanishes on shell. That's for sure. And so what we did was to call Q a bit like we did here for omega sigma. We call Q sigma of psi the associated integral on a certain Cauchy surface. Then we asked, and this is, of course, conserved and independent of Q. So we had angular momentum as an example. of a charge like this. Then what we did was to say, okay, let's imagine that we have a local symmetry. So what happens if we can choose our parameter psi pointwise on field space, so on space time? So it's not a global gate, global symmetry transformations anymore. And so we discussed that, for example, if we have our spacetime M with an initial surface and a final surface, we were completely free to choose psi on M in such a way that it vanishes up here, but not down there. And since by Noether first theorem, Q must be equal on both surface, but you're free to set 1 to 0, we find that in that case, Q of psi must identically must vanish on shell, not it. Okay? So because this, the conservation holds on shell, so Q sigma initial and Q sigma final will be equal on shell, but if since I can set 1 to 0, I find this result. So this is, this series of results go under the name of Noether second theorem. So from these, now, we argued that since since this must be true for all psi's, it means that roughly whatever this psi is multiplying should vanish. So let me write this a bit better. So we ended roughly at this point last time, and it got a bit confused, my exposition, because it was a bit rushed, so I want to redo that a bit more slowly. So if I write this like that, and now, in general, this will be some integral of psi and some derivative of psi. We can use Young-Mills as an example in a second. So I write these, let me write it like this, A alpha, which depends on my fields, X alpha plus A, B alpha I, Xi alpha. Let's say that there are no more than first derivatives, which is what actually happens in practical examples. So since this equation must hold for all psi's, it means that if I vary psi, it must also be zero. And so the idea is that if I integrate by parts, I can find a relationship that involves the phi's only. So this is also fine. So varying psi, what I find is that A alpha I minus D I B I alpha I vanishes. So I call this quantity C, the constraint. And so what I did implicitly is to write J, my current, is to write my current as this combination over here plus a total divergence, which I will call little j this time. And the theorem says that C So here I write sigma to remember myself that I'm working on the surface. I'm not working on spacetime anymore. I will go to spacetime in a second. So this is the pullback, in fact, of J to sigma. Takes this form where C vanishes on shell. And this piece is linear inside. There are no derivatives. All the derivatives have been packed into the little j. So basically, I took my expression for j, derived by parts to move all the derivatives onto whatever the coefficients of xi are. And so by doing so, I have a part which involves an expression that multiplies xi without derivatives, plus something that contains all the derivatives.
So,
yeah.
Here we have integrated J also, right?
Hmm? Sorry?
To get
C is the definition of this combination of.
To get that quantity is zero on shell, what we have done is used.
To say that must vanish for all possible size. And so it means that whatever it's multiplying should be zero. I can neglect the boundary terms. Because I can either consider xi of compact support or say there is no boundary and I just forget.
I see.
Either way, it works. So this is the constraint. So Inyang Mills, which is what we did in the tutorial example, j of xi was a trace of E wedge D psi, where D is the covariant derivative with respect to A. And so if I want to extract my this is working on the surface, Well, let me do first one other step, sorry. Before going to the example, it's easier to say one more thing here. So this must be true now for all sigma. Therefore, doing some gymnastics with, I write these reeling components and then say that it must be true for any possible choice of sigma, which appears here through this pullback. So there is some normal appearing and so on. So in the notes, I do the computation carefully, but it's not too hard to see that if an expression like this must hold for every sigma, it means that J itself can probably be decomposed into a part that vanishes on shell plus a total whatever. So I'm not proving the statement, but it just kind of makes sense that if a formula like this holds on every surface, then it must also hold in M. This means that J psi itself, not just its pullback on sigma, is of this form. Where now, C still vanishes on shell of the equations of motion. And this is what? This is a top minus one form on M. And the zero form on F. M, F. So it's a function of my fields. Here, and the top minus one form, because it's the same as J. And this little j is a top minus two form now. So let's see what they are in Yang Mills. The Yang Mills, as I was writing earlier, Jxi is equal to the trace of, remember, star F. So is the Hodge dual of the field strength wedge D the psi. Remember, F was the A wedge A wedge A plus A wedge A, and D psi is D psi plus psi, just the covariant derivative. So this is a very compact notation, as you learned. There are all sorts of indices that are being contracted. But that's so now, here the idea is not too hard in the sense that I know that what I have to do is to integrate by parts. So here I'm doing it abstractly, but in practice, it's actually quite simple to do in this example because I can write these as D of trace of star F psi. I'm trying to think about the signs. Minus trace of D star F psi. So this is my J. And these are the equations of motion, if you remember. So it's exactly what one expects to find. So clearly, this implies that J is conserved on shell, because on shell this vanishes and this actually become a trivial identity. So in particular, we find again Noether first theorem immediately as a consequence of this one. So what is this guy now? We see that it is, so F is a 2 form. Star F is a top minus 2 form, so we're happy. And in fact, physically, the interpretation of this, once I integrate it on the boundary of sigma, is the flux of the electric, is the outgoing electric flux of F. So if I'm in the situation where sigma has some boundary, the integral of, let me call it little q, of psi, which is the integral of j psi, is equal on partial sigma. In this case, is equal to the electric, I can write it explicitly, the star f trace of star f sigma psi. And in fact, if you look the components of this thing, this is nothing else than the integral, this is the metric on my corner, of trace. Well, you remember I introduced the bivector, which is the double normal of at the corner, which contains is the anti-symmetrized product of the time-like and space-like norms. So this is exactly that expression, FAB contracted with sigma. So this is, if you work out the components of this guy, is the electric field, electric flux through. And in electromagnetism, you know that this is related to the Gauss law. It says that the total charge inside the region is equal to the electric flux. Now, in the non-abelian case, things are much subtler. There is no obvious equality of this sort, but so one has to be careful about generalizing it to the non-abelian case. I will not explain why right now, but just keep that in mind. So, and now the fact that C vanishes on shell, of course, tells us that the Noether charge for gauge theories is actually a boundary charge. This is another way of thinking.
So the term boundary charge?
Yeah, I say boundary, corner, sorry, in this quarter, in the sense that it is on, usually the charges like angular momentum, you need to compute it on an entire Cauchy surface. But for gauge theories, what happens is that whatever is going on in the bulk of this surface drops, vanishes on shell, and everything, all the information is now captured at the corner. So this is very general. The problem is that these quantities are ambiguous. There are some ambiguities involved in defining them, because here, for example, the theta, I can always shift it by the d of something. And the same is true for r. And if I follow the mathematics, I find that this q can be affected by those choices. So in general, one has to find a principle to fix this ambiguity. And we will see that that for in gravity in a couple of lectures.
Do you need to fix that? Like usually, like energy, I'm also only computing like conserved charges, like energy, right? I only need to kind of like not care about the absolute value.
I don't hear you very well. Sorry, oh. With the mask, it's a bit muffled.
Yeah, sorry. So I was just wondering, do we actually need to fix that? Constant shift ambiguity thing?
It's not really a constant ambiguity. It's a, I can add whatever corner term to theta, which is not necessarily constant, and I can shift these. It can shift a lot. Yeah, but that's exact there, but on the corner is not exact. It's actually supported on the corner. Okay, so.
But then this would say that if you have d sigma, d sigma is 5, it means the end, everything will be 0, the charge will always be 0.
If I have, sorry?
If we don't have a boundary, that is d sigma equals.
Exactly, yeah. So in without boundaries, it's always 0. So what does it say is in electromagnetism, for example? That in a closed universe, the total charge must vanish. Because the flux line, you can also think about the flux line in that case, they have to end up somewhere. They start at positive charges and the negative ones, but they need to go somewhere. So if there is no boundary, then the total charge must vanish. And if there is a boundary, what I mean, like these corner surfaces, then they can just end there. And I don't know, you just when you glue the rest of it, they just get closed and cap. But precisely, this is precisely that statement, that the total electric charge in the universe, if the universe is closed, must be. And you know, if you did BRST, you set the charge to 0, no? You say, oh, the generator of my gauge symmetries must vanish. And this is, again, this statement. We know that in Young-Mills, J precisely generates gauge transformations, because we did write this Hamiltonian flow. I didn't write it here in the recap, but we know that a bit like the notation here is the same I use for the symplectic geometry. J is also the gauge generator, not always, but for Young-Mills it is. And then one sees that that generator now is precisely the constraints in the bulk. And if there is these corners, one needs to correct it by this, in this case, the electric flux. But in a closed universe, the constraint generates the gauge symmetry. So maybe I write, I continue my example here. In Young-Mills, what one finds is that this formula is true. We checked it. Do you remember? We checked that it ends up in this best case scenario situation where we have an invariant symplectic potential and R is actually 0. So we kind of have this simple situation. And so now, since J, I integrate over sigma, and if sigma has no boundary, what I find is that this now represents my phase space, right? Omega, because I know that there is that argument that without boundaries, omega sigma is conserved. And so this is, now I'm working formally, but in fact on phase space, and I find here that this is equal to Q sigma. But this on shell, where this is my phase space, this vanishes up to boundary terms. So if there is no boundary, this actually vanishes. So this is the statement that constraints generate gauge transformations. Again, gravity will be more complicated and we will get there, but in Young-Mills it works exactly like that. And BRST like elaborates on a lot, but that's the starting point to say that this is a bit like the BRST charge. If I replace Q with a ghost, I find the BRST.
So you're saying precisely the kernel of your symplectic form is your gauge generators?
Yes. So I didn't really say how I define my symplectic form on a given surface, so I would prefer not to get there. But yes, so roughly, one sees that gauge transformations are in the kernel of whatever it is. So this is different than global symmetries where, this is actually a number. This is the total angular momentum and doesn't need to be zero. So this is what I wanted to say.
J would be like the generator of the transformation that we have. But right now, I mean, what I get from that is like we have a constraint, but still J would be the generator. But you're mentioning the fact that the constraint would be the generator.
So in the absence of corners, once I integrate, J and C, J and the constraint become the same thing.
Right.
So does that? Does that answer the question? Good. So other questions before we move on to gravity? Okay. I'm a bit. Oh no, it's you.
So is the fact that we're kind of plugging in psi everywhere the reason that we don't have to worry about the psi and ambiguity of D and both D?
What do you mean, plugging in?
Well, we could just write this in terms of like one form higher and not have to write the vector field we're plugging in everywhere, right? Just with all these equations?
We need rho because this is, I mean, I don't have any J if I don't have both.
Like a covector field and stuff. So you just plug in the vector to get.
No, J. So J is a function on, is on J xi is a function on field space.
Right, but well, that means J is a co.
No, J is, so theta, where is it? Where is the definition? There. So I start from theta, which is a one form on field space, and I contract it with these vectors. These vectors, which are infinitesimal generators of the symmetry in field space.
Which are not necessarily vectors on the manifold. They could be just gauges.
Sure.
And the point is, those are just a very limited subset of vectors on field space. So these are very special contractions that I'm looking at. They're not generic contractions. So I cannot remove rho from these equations. I would be left with nothing. So these are about these very special transformations in field space, which correspond to symmetries. Whereas a generic change in fields, like in my field configurations, would not be anything. Would just be I go from one solution to another solution.
Right, I mean, the covector on like the Lie algebra.
Oh, you mean, yeah. So I can remove the Xi and work with dual-valued objects. Yeah, but then I would, well, okay, they're dual-valued with respect to the Lie algebra, sure.
I was just wondering if the fact that we're plugging it in, though, is why we don't have to worry about the sign ambiguity of D versus bold D.
No, that doesn't, it's not so much about that. They're unrelated.
Sure.
Because Xi is not graded, so I can put it in when as I want without worrying about sign. Okay, so GR. So we will see that the what went through very smoothly in Young Mills will start showing, we will start seeing the troubles coming up in GR, which are actually it will be signature of very important phenomena that happens that happen in that theory. So let's start from the beginning. We have our action is the we will use the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is So this is epsilon. I call it epsilon, and what I mean is square root of g. They determine the absolute value of the determinant of the metric times the top form. So this is the volume element. And what this is multiplying is 1/2 of the Ricci scalar, which I would like to write is minus lambda. It is just the usual. The usual Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. So my field space, in this case, is the space of matrix. And when I write, so here's some notation for the following. This is my fundamental one form, right? So what I used to call d phi I in general, in this case, is equal to d dab. But sometimes I will need to raise indices. But when I write these, I don't mean the variation of the inverse. I mean these with indices raised. It's just a sign difference, but just to understand each other when I write formulas, it's good to keep this in mind. I mean, it's a detail, but it's when doing computations actually matters.
Oh, I think you missed the minus.
Sorry?
You missed the minus?
No, I don't want the minus. That's precisely the point. I want these to mean these with indices raised and not the variation of the inverse. If I'm varying the inverse, there would be a minus, right? So this is the gen. So, and the other notation that I want to introduce is dg, which is not d of the determinant or the trace, is the trace of the variation. So this will help. But again, is a detail mostly to follow computations than actually to understand the. But these are definitions, they're nothing, just notation. Okay, but now with these, I can write the variation of my Lagrangian, which is dAB, dGB, theta, where now you will not be surprised to see what is hiding in here, of course, these are Einstein's equation. GAB is the Einstein tensor. and left. Let's leave it out. Yeah. And maybe I write this. And theta. Okay, so these might be new to you because usually one doesn't really worry about the boundary terms. So it's good to write it once. Delta V. And we will need it for the current and so on. So it's important for us to have. So is what is this? I had introduced it in the tutorial, but this is epsilon contracted with one direction, or if you want, it's also GAB of star. So essentially, it is the volume for it's something that when you pull back on a surface, gives you the volume element on that surface times the conormal. So if I take this is the volume element on the surface, induced volume, times Na, the normal to the surface. So. So this is just going to give me integrations by part automatically. When I integrate theta, I get. Yeah, does it make sense? If I integrate theta on sigma, I get this expression contracted with Na, the normal, times the volume element, the right volume element automatically.
Can you say that log B G is not the variation of the inverse, but usually in the Einstein equation, when we get that equation, we treat that as a variation of the inverse, right?
I mean, they are related by a sign, so there's not a huge difference.
There's no sign change in the equation.
I mean, I can change this sign and call this. Yeah, it's this is the equations of motion are all.
Okay.
You don't care about the global sign; they're equal to zero, and that's the only.
I see.
And if there was matter, it would be already in the parentheses with the right sign, wouldn't be outside. So it just doesn't. The global sign does. Okay, so this, just to say, this weird symbol, you don't have to worry too much about. It's just saying that it's what allows you to do these fluxes, essentially. You have, this is a current, it has an index open, A. So when integrated over sigma, you get N contracted with that index, and then you integrate with the right volume form. So GAB, probably everybody knows what it is, but just for completeness. It's always nice to write. Okay. So there are different ways of writing this quantity, and unfortunately, I might have forgotten to print. We'll do it next time. You can write it also in terms of variations of the Christoffel symbols, which is also a common way to write it. But I don't want to write things that are wrong, so I will not. Yeah, I forgot to print the right pages. Anyway, so we will write it next time. This can also be written in terms of something multiplying delta gamma. And this looks more like Young-Mills, where you have E delta A gamma is a bit like A because it's what you use to take covariant derivatives. So it's just, it's also a nice quiz. But yeah, so for today, we just need this. So next ingredient, we have the Lagrangian. We want to talk about the symmetries. So our G, in this case, is are the diffeomorphisms of M. What are they? Well, they are the vector fields on M with the Lie brackets on M. So this, is there any question about this piece? Can I go further? Okay. So now, how do they act? The only field I have, as we said, is the metric. So the only thing I care is that how does GAB act on my metric? And this is, there are different ways of writing this, but a good one, the first one should remember is the Lie derivative. So this is how diffeomorphism act on a quantity is by Lie derivative, on a tensor is by Lie derivative. And these can be written, I just go a little slow just to make sure. This can be written like this, which is the usual definition of the Lie derivative in coordinates. But of course, this is also the same as this famous formula. But here, psi b has an index lowered. And so this is tricky because now this depends on the metric. So if I take variations, I have to be careful of what's happening to this guy. And this also depends on the metric now. Whereas index up do not depend on the metric, index down do because they're obtained by contraction. So in many ways, this is simpler, but if I need to take variations, can be confusing. Now, we know that our Lagrangian is a tensor density, which just means that it's a covariant object which is coordinate independent. So it means that if I take, in the language of field space, this means that one has this beautiful identity over here, which one has to stare a bit to really appreciate. It looks very simple, but we will go through it slowly. So this equation. Expresses the general covariance or the background independence of the theory. So this is sometimes called general covariance. So it is extremely, extremely important. Everything that will follow will depend on this. So what does it say? It is saying the following. On the left-hand side, I'm changing my field. I take a metric, and I look what happens to an abelian metric, which is related to the previous one by a symmetry. On the right-hand side, I'm doing an operation on spacetime, where I'm actually taking a tensor and pushing it forward along my vector. So they are two very different operations, and background independence says that they coincide. For example, what happens if my Lagrangian contained a preferred direction, which is fixed? Then maybe I can still act on this vector field, this fixed vector field, with the Lie derivative. That would be fine. What I cannot do, because it's fixed, there's no action on the left-hand side in field space, unless included, but that would not be fixed anymore. So if it is this background quantity, a fixed vector field, then I'm not allowed to vary it in field space because it's not part of it. And so I would lose these equality, even though my Lagrangian might look covariant because all the indices are contracted the right way. But if the object is not part of field space, it would not appear on my left hand side. So this is how this simple equation is actually very important, because it's saying that all the matter field, all the field content of the theory is covariant. It's not fixed. It's changing by in the appropriate way.
This is some condition we impose, or
this is a property of that Lagrangian on that field space. But more generally, this would hold even adding matter fields and so on, as long as I don't introduce in my Lagrangian any what's called the background quantity, which would be something you do not vary when taking the equations of motion. So if you cannot vary it when you take the equations of motion, it means that it's not featured in the left-hand side.
Means that what we vary to get the equation of motion is just the metric.
Yes. Okay. Let me give you an example. So suppose I use as a Lagrangian something like this, square root of g, d for x, and now I have ea da phi square 1/2. So this looks like, well, maybe I can also add, if we want, let's do it a bit more rich here, m square phi square. So this is a scalar field. Let me do it a bit more slowly, because so this is. So let's consider M. I've seen William East explaining this, so probably it's good to give an example that uses it. So suppose we have a fixed foliation. So where sigma, what do I want to write? I want to write that I have sigma t, which is the surface at which some function t takes value t small. But this is fixed. I fix my foliation. And so on. And now I can write a Lagrangian for a scalar field, what do I need? I need also, well, let's call it n, na da phi squared. Okay, I put it outside, so that's good. Plus, maybe I want to put some derivative on my surface. So these are along my surface, for example, plus m squared phi squared. So these are along sigma t. So this looks like the usual covariant Lagrangian written in a 3+1 way, in a split. But now, if this n here is actually fixed, by this function, I want this foliation to be fixed, not to be varied, then although this looks like a perfectly fine Lagrangian, which looks covariant because I'm contracting all the indices in the right way, in fact, when I take field variation, since I'm not varying this structure, then it wouldn't satisfy background independence. Or in fact, probably an even simpler example that they just thought about, but this is, I should have written this first. Suppose I write it like this, GAB DA phi DB phi plus M square phi square, but I just look at these as a function of phi. So there's no, so my field space is just phi. It's not G. Then it wouldn't satisfy this because I'm not allowed to vary G on the left-hand side of this equation. So this is my background metric, which I'm not changing, not touching. And but it is still, it looks coordinate independent. That's fine. That's true because the right-hand side would be zero up to boundary terms, but not the left-hand side. You see what I'm trying to say?
So, but then, so what I was thinking is then this is imposing some constraints on what terms we can add in the Lagrangian, right? It's imposing some constraints on what type of matter we can have.
I would see the other way. This is telling you that all the fields that appear in the Lagrangian must be dynamical. Otherwise, there is no possible way you can satisfy that.
All the fields, okay. Okay, as long as they're dynamical.
And transform in the right way, but you would never put a field that doesn't transform in the right way. That's out of the way.
And somehow this equation also gives me an impression that any change in field can be thought of as a change in space-time. Any change in Lagrangian due to a field change can be thought of as a space-time transformation.
Yeah, every change in field space due to a diffeomorphism, one of these symmetries, can be thought of as a, yeah. So this is sometimes said, there are two ways of thinking about diffeomorphic symmetry, active and passive, which is utterly confusing. So active, one means that one is changing your metric, your geometry. So this is our left-hand side. Passive is a change in coordinate. So it's not quite this, but this closely related to this. In fact, one could also think of this as active, but that would be yet another layer. But you can think of it a bit like that. So there are these two ways, and this is saying that this varies the field, and this varies if you want the.
So this is like an input from GR we are having, where we are saying that there cannot be any background field as such.
Yeah, precisely. So, good. Are there other questions about this? I went through the wrong detour over there, but I hope that this second example was actually clearer.
We think equality between passive and active. How this is equivalent with the sentence that you said, everything should be dynamical.
Sure. So there are lots of ways of thinking of this active-passive. So it's maybe I shouldn't spend. It can turn very confusing very quickly. That's a problem. But in a sense, what I mean there is that in one case I'm changing the field themselves. I'm not touching my manifold. My manifold is what it is. If you want, with its coordinates, whatever they are, I don't care. I'm changing my fields on top of the manifold. Changing field configuration. And on the other hand, what I'm saying is I'm doing something on my manifold, whether it's changing of coordinate or pushing it around, I don't care, but it's something about the manifold, the base.
That's true. I think this says that the thing that vary is related to geometry. These are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And your example is again.
Yeah. Good. So now let's look at the consequences of this in the last 5 minutes. So since L is a top form on spacetime, we know that we can apply Cartan's formula here. And this vanishes because this is already a top form, so I cannot differentiate it further. So this is just not there. And I find this equation for my lead derivative on the right-hand side. So now this is telling me what R is, because I know that D are, you remember xi, this thing that I need for the neutral current, is defined as the variation of the Lagrangian along the symmetry, like the leftover boundary term, and this is exactly this now, by background independence. So this is just saying that the Lagrangian is a top form. There is no other information in this equation. So this implies that R is equal to xi L. So this is one ingredient we need. The second ingredient we need, and of course, I could write it in many ways, but I don't think we need to write it explicitly right now. Well, no, actually, it could be useful because here I want to write xi explicitly. So let me explain what I mean. I mean 1/2 r minus lambda, which is my L here. And now what is the form? The form is this epsilon. So contracting epsilon with xi is what I have. And this is, if you want, this xi a epsilon a of before. So is the normal component, if I integrate it on a surface, would be the normal component of. So this, I cannot write it because I'm still in space-time, so there is no sigma. But if I pull back this on a sigma, this would be the normal component of.
Excuse me, we have another ambiguity here, right? When we modify the r, but we set it equal to zero. Like, for instance, I can
add an exact form. You could add stuff, for sure. I always neglected this problem. In the notes, I explain how it works. I will come back to it when I need it. But as long as I don't really need it, I prefer to be a bit fudgy. But you're right. This is one choice. The important thing in this game, there are two things that one should be careful. The first thing is to be consistent. Whenever I make a choice somewhere, I need to use the same choice elsewhere. So that's the first thing that I cannot escape. The second thing is check that the quantity I really care about are non-ambiguous. For example, that little q was ambiguous. So if I really care about it in a computation where I want to claim something about physics, I need to make sure that I have a good reason to fix the ambiguity in that way. But that's a question about physics more than math. That quantity is ambiguous. One has to check if whether physics-wise there is a good reason to fix it the way we did. Let's see. Maybe then I stop here.